So we had a nice segue in our last presentation from hacking objects you wear on your body. We're now coming to hacking the body or the technology of the living substance. It's called biohacking, and I'd like to talk about what it means, what are the roots and the basics of biohacking, what can you understand about under this term, and what it might mean for our future and for diverse social implications of this technology. Let's say the basic technology below biohacking, I would say, is called synthetic biology. And you can see the term in similar ways that, as you can understand synthetic chemistry, or in a way synthetic physics, IT, electronics. It's a way to form and make things that normally occur only in nature by man. So this is the most accepted definition of synthetic biology. It's the design and construction of new biological parts, devices, or systems. So it's a very engineering kind of language used here. Or it's also the redesign of existing natural biological systems for useful purposes. So this is the most accepted definition. You can see here that the term construction, you can see redesign. So all the things you normally hear only in engineering, in chemistry, and in this kind of engineering fields, they are now applied to biology. This field has become more popular in the last 10 years, but actually the term synthetic biology goes back 100 years to this gentleman. It's Stéphane Leduc, a biologist, who published this book in 1912, exactly 100 years ago, called La Biologie Synthétique. He wanted to understand the processes of living systems and what's the difference between living and the non-living. So he experimented with crystal gardens, so the formation of crystals. And that time crystals were seen as something semi-living because they exhibited the feature of growth that also living systems have, plants and animals. So here we've got an abiotic, a non-living process and characteristic that he wanted to understand and investigate in order to find out how it actually contributes to one of the characteristics of life. So that was also in the area of synthetic chemistry, and he had the vision that you can make biological objects and biofacts by man. Then actually every generation had its proponents of a synthetic biology or synthetic life. In 1972 it was James Danieli from the US, and he proposed also kind of synthetic biology, artificial synthesis of new life forms. There was even right at the beginning of the genetic engineering revolution, where people started to take genes out of one organism and transfer it to another one. And he had a much, much bigger vision, not just to transfer single genes, but to make the whole organism anew. And he also observed what I mentioned in the beginning, that every, let's say, scientific field may undergo a kind of evolution of three steps. The first step is of observation or description. You see that in chemistry, in physics. Also in biology, there's a plant and you describe it and you name it, put it into a category. The next thing is an analysis. You try to find out in terms of biology how it works and are there different chemicals inside? How do they work together? Where does this plant occur? How does this animal reproduce and stuff like that? So, and the next step is synthesis. Once you've understood how the things work, you can actually go ahead and actually produce it yourself. Right, like in chemistry, we found different chemicals in the environment, and suddenly, 100 years ago, people started to reproduce these chemicals in the laboratory without the need of extracting them from nature. Another big proponent, or let's say, kind of godfather of synthetic biology, is Richard Feynman, who just before he died wrote this one of his last words, written on a chalkboard in Caltech, was, "What I cannot create, I do not understand." So this is the ultimate engineering mantra, that in order to understand how things work as an engineer, as a physicist, but also a biologist, you actually have to create it, you have to build it. And only when it then works, it proves that you have understood it to a certain extent. So here's the last generation, the current contemporary generation of synthetic biologists, Drew Andy, Adam Arkin, and Tom Knight here from MIT. And Tom Knight was also one of the proponents, one of the chief or main scientists and engineers in the IT revolution. And they produced for DARPA a paper in 1999 presenting a standard parts list of biological circuitry. So they actually took the logic of electronic circuits where you have defined parts that you can put together in a certain way and then get a bigger, more complex system with very well-defined properties, and take this concept and apply it to biology. Because if you go to biology and do genetic engineering, as it is called, it's far, far away from what people do in real engineering disciplines, like electronic engineering or when you're building bridges or computers. Because in that field, the people tend to know more or less exactly what they do, not perfectly, but to a large degree. But in biology, it's not so. It's mainly a dark box, it's a black box. There's a lot of uncertainty, there's a lot of lack of knowledge, and most of the time the experiments don't work. So they want to go ahead and take the complexity and uncertainty out of biology and construct it from the very beginning. So in a way, it's very interdisciplinary. You have engineers coming into synthetic biology, but also biologists, chemists. So it's a kind of new technoscience that is composed of very different people from different fields and different cultures. And I'd like to talk about the influence that's coming from engineering computing and the biohacking, open access ideas that's coming from that part. So you might find different people and different definitions of synthetic biology. I have five, let's say, subfields, of which I would like to introduce two that are most relevant for this presentation here. And this is DNA synthesis, the production, writing of DNA, not just the reading of it, sequencing, but also the writing. And then the construction of, what I said, biological circuits made of standard biological parts. Just that you know there are more subfields, which is in one place the minimal genome, is the attempt to take a life form and reduce it to the most simplest form possible. So life is very complex, but you can take away some genes and some parts, characteristics of life, and this remaining organism would still be able to survive. So the question is, how much can you take away so that it will still be alive? And then you will find out what is the bare minimum of living systems. This comes from top down. If you take existing organisms and make them simpler, but you can also take approach bottom up. You start with basic chemicals and put them together in the right way that at one point you would have something that you call alive. So make a living systems out of basic chemicals. And then the last aspect is xenobiology. It's not just to reproduce or remake living systems in the laboratory, but actually to make living organisms that are chemically different from the things we know in nature. For example, you would have a different chemical, not DNA that stores the information, but GNA. They would work in a similar way, but are different chemicals and would not be able to communicate with natural systems, with natural organisms. Let's talk a little bit about DNA synthesis, which is really the one of the core technologies in synthetic biology that also can be used for amateur biologists. So the idea is that you have the code, the code of life, the genetic code, but then it can genetic information, a series of bases that define which proteins are expressed, which define the color of your eye, or probably more or less how tall you're going to be, or other chemical, biochemical functions in your body. So that are to a certain degree are known, which genes are responsible for what characteristics, and you can take this or find it on a computer, copy it onto your local DNA synthesis machine, which is the thing here. There are a couple of bottles with different chemicals, then actually produce the DNA, the genetic information physically. So instead of a paper with a text, there's a piece of DNA coming out. You can stitch that together and make a whole genome, right? And here's the little history of what has been possible in the past. It was in the 70s that for the first time a little tiny piece of RNA was synthesized. Later on, it was the first synthesized gene, so probably a couple of hundred, a thousand base pairs long, a stretch of DNA. But it actually became more interesting in 2002 when a research team from the US for the first time synthesized the DNA of a complete virus. So they actually made the virus without the physical virus at hand. They didn't copy it, they didn't clone it. They just took the information from the internet, put it onto the DNA synthesizer and made the virus. A couple of years later, they actually reproduced the Spanish flu from 1918. this virus does not exist anymore. It was the biggest pandemic disease in the last hundreds of years. And they actually went to permafrost soils, dug out dead people from the soil, people that died from the Spanish flu, and got some of their lung tissue, and were able to actually sequence, read the information of this influenza virus back then, put it into a computer, and make it again. So it actually infected lung cells in the laboratory and proved that it worked. So it actually brought back alive, if you want to say, a virus that was extinct for almost 100 years. Of course, that raised a lot of biosecurity issues, of which I would like to mention a few in the next slides. And I don't know maybe if you've heard about it, a team 2 years ago claimed to have created the first synthetic organism. Actually, what they have done is they synthesized a really long stretch of DNA that is like the 1 million base pairs long, quite a achievement, and then placed it into, it's an empty bacterial cell, a cell that had where its own DNA had been taken away. It was implanted, and then this new cell started took over this new DNA and started to reproduce and was alive. So in a way, the synthetic DNA produced in the laboratory was booted up in a cell and was in a way part of a living system. And what is interesting is the increase in capabilities. It's sometimes compared to Moore's law in electronics, which you probably all know. It's that every 18 years the number of transistors on a chip doubles, and you can see here the number of base pairs, so the length of DNA, is also growing exponentially. And interestingly, the last couple of years it's growing hyper exponentially, faster than Moore's law. So this is the number of DNAs of base pairs synthesized, and recently a team from Harvard, George Church, they managed to synthesize 5 million base pairs for the first time. You can see that it will easily go up to the length of a plant or animal. Although it's not yet possible to actually write something useful, what they do is they actually totally copy, or almost totally copy, things that they find in nature. Nobody right now knows how to create a new kind of living organism, because that is still far away from the scientific knowledge. So this is actually helping the second aspect I want to talk about, is the biological circuits. And here's one example. Actually, the most famous example is the creation of a specific chemical, and it also reflects this description and analysis and synthesis approach. In the old times, artemisinin, this is an anti-malaria compound found in a Chinese plant, Artemisia annua, Chinese wormwood. And it grows there. You can find it in nature. You can grow it, plant it, cultivate it, and extract the chemical directly from the plant. This has been done for hundreds of years with traditional Chinese medicine. And about, 80 years ago, for the first time, chemists were able to synthesize this molecule, which is quite important for this anti-malaria treatment, in the laboratory. And then, about 5 years ago, for the first time, some scientists were able to take a number of genes from wormwood and different species and actually implant it into yeast. It's a little, let's say, it's the biotechnology cell factory that is very commonly used. It's kind of the typical workhorse of biotechnologists. And they implanted a new chemical genetic system into yeast so that for the first time it was able to produce artemisinin acid, kind of precursor of this thing. So it seems that this system can produce artemisinin in a much cheaper way than it was possible in the past, and it got a lot of attention. Here's a very, I won't explain it in very detail, but the point is that they took 12 or 15, in the order of 12 genes from different species, and put them together in the right way so that they were able to produce this chemical. And this is quite different from, in a way, different from traditional genetic engineering, where we'd only take one or two or very few genes and implant it, and very rarely would they work together. And the idea from Andy Knight and Arkin about the standard biological parts has since 1999 actually got some more support from a lot of people, and there's now something called the standardized bioparts. So the idea is that, like in electronics, you have a registry or a book, a catalog, where you can go and search for different parts that you want and order them and build something. And here is a registry for standard biological parts. The idea is that you can order them or have them available and put together some interesting functions you're interested in. And if you go for take a specific part, this is what it looks like. is a base pair combination that represents a specific function. Here's an example of what can be done. Again, taking an analogy or metaphor from electronic engineering. Here's an oscillator, and they took this concept of an oscillator and implanted it or built it inside a cell. So here's the genetic circuit of the oscillator, and at the end it produces a protein that glows green. And here is a timeline, and over, let's say, a couple of hours, the production of this fluorescent green protein is oscillating. So it's going up and down, up and down. You can see, so this is a proof that it was possible to engineer an oscillator inside a cell. Right, so just imagine if it would be possible, if it really works. It's just, there are a lot of problems and still, it's not easy to actually make that happen. It's not that easy that you can order parts and put them together and make something. It's still complicated and uncertain, and a lot of tinkering is involved. But let's assume this is going to help people to engineer something useful. Then one of the main proponents says that it's exactly what you want to do. Exactly, it's to make biology easier to engineer, right? So that in a couple of years that many more people can actually have an idea what they want to do with a cell, and then just do it without having to own a big research lab or having to work in a university for a couple of years, but just do it very easily. And the first kind of success in this instance is iChem. iChem is a student competition. It's called the International Genetic Engineered Machine Competition. Where it has become quite popular in the last couple of years. So there were only a couple of teams at the beginning in 2004 and about 160 last year. And they're all manufacturing interesting biological systems. And I have here some examples for you. Most of the, except from yeast, another workhorse of biotechnologists, this E. coli is a bacteria that lives in your intestines. It doesn't smell very good, so these students went along and changed the smell of E. coli, so it would smell like banana or like wintergreen, so they wouldn't be so nasty in the laboratory. Here's another example: BioBeer, an American student group. They were a bit disappointed that the French, they said, they don't eat so healthy as the Americans. I don't know if this is true. But they drink a lot of red wine and they live longer because that's what they're reasoning. Resveratrol, an anti-aging compound, is part of red wine. And the Americans that drink beer, they don't have this resveratrol. So what did they do? They took the gene from the rape and transplanted it into yeast. So they actually came up with a beer that also contained resveratrol, and they called it an anti-aging beer. It actually really brooded, and they got calls from people who want to buy it and drink it, but of course, that was not an option for them. Here's another example from the winning team of 2009.
eCRMI is an experimental collaboration between designers and scientists working in synthetic biology. In 2009, seven Cambridge University undergraduates spent the summer learning the tools of synthetic biology, which is essentially a new approach to genetic engineering. Using standardized sequences of DNA in a format that's called BioBricks, they learned to engineer bacteria. They designed their own BioBricks using genes copied from existing organisms, inserted them into E. coli, and created bacteria that secrete colors visible to the naked eye. eCRMI went on to win the International Genetically Engineered Machine Competition at MIT in 2009.
And joining us now is one of the winners of the iGEM competition. Welcome to Science Friday, Ms. Mullen.
Hi, thank you so much. I'm part of the Cambridge 2009 iGEM team, and our project was called eCRMI. And what we were trying to do is to improve bacterial biosensors. They're bacteria that can tell you the concentration of a pollutant in water. And they can do this because inside them they have a detector. So we developed two different parts, the sensitivity tuner, and this actually tells the detector when to turn on and when to turn off. So you have control over what level of the pollutant you're detecting.
And how does the bacteria show that it's on or off?
We use something called a color generator, which means that our bacteria changed color when the detector got switched on.
Wow, so they light up in a different color.
They actually change color visible to the naked eye.
So let's say if you put a swab of the bacteria in a polluted river, bacteria would just change color.
Yep, exactly. So you'd probably want to put a sample of your water on a bacterial plate, maybe not the other way around.
Well, how would you envision something like this being used other ways in the future?
As designers, we worked with the team to explore euchromite's potential as they were developing it in the lab. And together, we imagined a timeline proposing ways that living color could evolve over the next century. These scenarios, some of which are shown in this film, explore the different agendas that could shape euchromite's use and in turn our everyday lives.
One of the first real applications for this technology may arrive quite soon. A cheap disposable biosensor for testing groundwater contaminated by arsenic.
Bacteria could also be used to produce natural colourings and dyes. By 2015, there may be a profession of people who hunt for new pigments in the genes responsible, bringing them back for use in the food and textile industry. By 2039, you can go to the supermarket and buy the simple probiotic yogurt for cheap personalised disease monitoring. The yogurt drink contains E. coli bacteria, which establish a colony in your gut. They monitor for chemical signals that indicate the presence of a wide range of diseases. If they detect a disease, they start generating the corresponding coloured pigment, producing an easily visible output to prompt you to seek your doctor.
2049 sees the rise of the Orange Liberation Front, a terrorist organisation from the Netherlands, who are angry because a biotech company in China has patented the gene for the colour orange.
In 2069, Google releases pollution mapping bacteria into the atmosphere that turn red in the presence of excess CO2. As the saying goes, red sky in the morning, Google health warning.
Our collaboration meant that euchromite was a technology that's designed from the start at both the genetic and the human scale, and with a long-term outlook. We found that design and science could have a meaningful exchange in the lab, which could prove useful when developing technologies in the future.
You know, I think it's a new term to most of the public, synthetic biology. You know, we've heard about all kinds of genetic engineering, stem cell research, but I think the phrase synthetic biology has not been used a lot lately, but I guess we're going to be hearing more of it.
Example of an iGEM project. Here's another one that won a recent honorable mention at Ars Electronica as well. And they had a more critical approach to iGEM and bioengineering in a way.
So they actually produced a little suit that contained enough little tools so that people would go into remote places and collect specimens from nature. So these are a group from Bangalore, India, and they would equip are farmers from India that can't read and don't have a lot of education, but they would actually go into remote places and collect some soil samples or plant samples and bring them to the laboratory. So do-it-yourself biologists could actually go and check if some of these biobricks were in the environment, so that they have been released unknowingly or accidentally into the environment. So instead of actually contributing to the hype of synthetic biology and coming up with more and better and more interesting and funny proposals, they actually went, had a different approach and thought about the consequences of this engineering and spreading of technology into many different hands. And that leads me to saying the DOI, bioamateur biology kind of approach. And here is Freeman Dyson, who's a kind of a very interesting physicist. Probably know him, and he has something to say about biotechnology.
Talk for 1 minute about the future of biotechnology, because I think I know very little about that. I'm not a biologist, so everything I know about it can be said in 1 minute. What I'm saying is that we should follow the model that has been so successful with the electronic industry, that what really turned computers into a great success in the world as a whole is toys. As soon as computers became toys, when kids could come home and play with them, then the industry really took off. And that has to happen with biotech. There's a huge... when people have this technology in their hands. You have a do-it-yourself biotech kit. Grow your own dog, grow your own cat. Just buy the software, you design it. I won't say any more. You can take it on from there. It's going to happen. And it will, I think it has to happen before the technology becomes natural, becomes part of the human condition, something that everybody is familiar with and everybody accepts.
Actually, some people took Freeman Dyson quite serious and founded a movement or groups that are called do-it-yourself biologists, or as another analogy to IT in the computer industry, you not only have software or hardware, you only have wetware. And do-it-yourself biology or amateur biology is a kind of biohacking, taking this technology and using it in a different way, a subversive way, but in a creative way. And here's an example of what this could look like. This is from a workshop in Melbourne, or also took place, organized by Symbiotica, which is an art science organization in Australia. And here we are constructing a sterile hood. You know, if you work with biological substances, you have to take care that they're not contaminated with different bacteria that are everywhere in the air, on your fingers. So you need a place that is sterile. And normally these sterile hoods are quite expensive. They're in the laboratories, but you can actually make them yourself with quite cheap ways. So we bought some from the hardware store, bought some big plastic trays, and then fill it around a little bit. You get some HEP filters that are used for people that have paranoid for bacteria. They can have them in their vacuum cleaners and can use that. So you can hack around and make your own equipment. And here's almost the final piece. And this is actually the do-it-yourself, did-it-ourself sterile hood. And we did a little experiment in here. And there's a constant air circle going around and cleaning the air, making sure nothing is contaminated. It's quite cheap. It costs just a couple of maybe 100 euros or so. Of course, it's not so big and not so fancy, but it's something you can work with. Here's a do-it-yourself incubator. You have your cells. You need to grow them at a certain temperature for a couple of hours or days, and here we control temperature and make sure that the things grow very well. Here's a different version. I think it was the first one we did. It wasn't so fancy. This is from here in Vienna. Another version of the sterile hood. This looks more like a high biosafety level 3 or 4, very dangerous kind of thing, but you can stick your hands in and then don't stick on the stuff. Another more fancy incubator, you can see there are different versions that we control the temperature and stuff like that. Similar to the Arduino system, the hardware system, we also have something in the wetware. This is an open PCR, polymerase chain reaction. It's a very important tool in the laboratory. You can multiply genes or stretches of DNA, billion folds, and it's very important if you want to detect something. And this guy actually, he produced this kit. You can actually make it yourself as well. The whole the heart, the blueprint is available. You can do it yourself, or you buy the complete set, and in a couple of hours you can produce it yourself. It costs about $500 or $400. So there are many groups around the world, mainly in the US. We started in Boston, and went then to San Francisco, and from then to many other places. And many of them already have space, a laboratory where people can go, like just like a hackerspace. They pay a little bit, or it's paid by other people, and they go and they do something. San Francisco is the BioCurios. They are also doing courses with people. They come and learn about biotechnology. Also in Austria, we have three. Now we have the fourth one. One is in Leeds. Also, after joining us called BioFab, there is one in Vienna, and Dr. Burgasser is the Vienna Open Lab. But normally, they have a little bit of a different agenda. They want to take your school kids and want to show them how biotechnology works. A little bit of a different agenda, but it's kind of a system that could be used later on to make a real hackerspace. This is something that is not yet a hackerspace. It's a Zwischenraumnutzung, an old hospital. Is not used anymore, Otto Wagner Spital in Vienna, and there's a Pavilion 35, which we could use for some time to mess around, but we didn't do anything dangerous.
there was a former mental hospital, so we tried to do scare the shit out of someone. Right, so and I'd not like to talk about what that could be.
Just imagine that the DOI, the bio branch of technology develops in some way, not maybe not the same way, not as fast or as quick, but in some way. What could that mean? First question that comes to mind is about safety. So how would you feel if your neighbor starts experimenting with bacteria in his kitchen right next to your door? If you live in the countryside, he's doing it outside, maybe over his garage. So would you feel comfortable with that? Is this guy actually knowing what he's doing? He doesn't have a formal training, but he has this equipment and doing genetic engineering in his spare time. I don't know. So maybe the biosafety aspect is quite an important one in many ways. And there's also the security aspect. And in German, we only have one word for that, Sicherheit. But actually, in many languages, there are two. And there are two different meanings for that. Safety talks about the unintentional consequences, so accidents, something you do not intend. Where biosecurity is the intentional use of biology as a weapon, like in bioterrorism or biowarfare or crime. This is quite important to make a distinction between these two. There's a paper I wrote in 2008 about what could happen if biology is going to diffuse or distribute to a large user base. I mean, you can think about making drugs more cheaply, but also all kinds of diseases that could come out of that without the people wanting to do it. I guess that most of, or almost all of the people that are working as amateur biologists are very positive, constructive. They don't want to do harm. I haven't come across a single person that I would know about. But even though if you don't know what you're doing and you don't keep to the safety requirements, you might cause some problems later on, which you don't intend. So to ruling that out is a very important point. And there's another important point that, as we'll talk about this later, the democratization of biotechnology will have an economic and a political economic consequence, which is in a way can change the rules that are now existing for pharmaceutical products, all kinds of bio-related products. And this would be a way to actually this will be a way for biohackers to take them out of the game, right, if they don't follow the safety rules. But this is the first thing that will be used against amateur biologists. Second point is biosecurity. It's a similar situation. And I have here, you probably heard of Steve Kurtz, the Critical Art Ensemble. Oops. That should be a film. Actually, I think I can say something about it. It's an artist from the Critical Art Ensemble, and he was doing bio art. He had biological equipment at home, had art exhibitions, was clearly an artist using biological instruments and tools. And his wife died of a heart attack in 2004. And when the police came, when the doctors came, they saw this equipment, they alerted the police. Police came, alerted the FBI. FBI came in hazmat suits and with weapons and took all of the stuff away. And this was just a few years after 9/11. They were very, let's say, sensitive to kind of bioterrorism. And they took the things away. He was actually also taken. He was questioned. And he got a lawsuit. They wanted to get him into... sued in a way. But in the end, he was cleared because he wasn't a terrorist, so it wasn't the reason why his wife died. It was just unrelated. But it showed that there's a kind of sensitivity to that. And also the FBI, they didn't know what to do with this person. Because he was one guy that some strange... He actually, in the film, he says that he has an Arabic writing at home, no? And then the guy's asking him, what is Arabic writing about, no? And he says he was invited to an art show in Egypt or something, and it was an invitation, but it was taken as some kind of relation to bioterrorism. So in the end, he was cleared. And probably he was very personally, very much affected by this situation, and he came up with a very critical art piece. So in 2007, he went to Leipzig, and they took Bacillus subtilis, which can be used as has similar properties when you disperse it into air as anthrax has. And he had a team of about 15 people, and they were ordered to walk around in Leipzig, and they did it in very close neighborhood to the American embassy. And he had then some people spraying Bacillus subtilis around, close to the American embassy. And his people were actually walking around. And after 2 or 3 days, they took some probes from their clothes and gave it to the scientists in Leipzig. And then they tried to find out which kind of bacteria they found. And in some cases, they found Bacillus subtilis, although they didn't know it, which is if it was the one that was sprayed out or came from a different source. But it was a kind of a test run, a harmless test run in an urban environment of biosecurity. And in a way, it was also a critical way to talk about how biosecurity and bioterrorism is actually, in a way, also misused or used or interpreted in a very sensitive way. The whole Steve Kurtz case actually didn't fall very back very nicely and was not very well received, as of course, in the art world, but also the FBI realized that it wouldn't be a good idea to actually just come in a very hostile way, so they're now having a different approach, that they're at the IGM meetings, they're having a booth there, they're talking to the organizers and want to make sure that all the people are on the same page, and instead of them actually checking what people are doing, they want the IGM students to have an open eye and ear and to see what their colleagues are doing. So if someone's acts funny or in a strange way, they actually go and report to the FBI. And they also have these do-it-yourself biology groups. They do some regular workshops. The last one was in June 2012 in San Francisco. They invited representatives from all the different DIY clubs all over the world and just talked to them. It was a private invitation, and they had a discussion about it, what they're doing, or that they don't do anything harmful. So there is someone having a look at what the DIY community is doing. In terms of intellectual property rights, we also see an interesting situation here, in a way similar to the software and hardware industry. In biotechnology, many tools and reagents and stuff like that is patented. So there's a lot of patents are very important in that business models. And in synthetic biology, there's at least a group that is aiming for open access and open source in biotechnology. So for example, these standardized parts, the idea is to have them open access. And it's going to be seen which of the two models is actually going to win or be more attractive, or if they can coexist, or if it's clear when it's a patent and when it's open source, because that is also not always clear. That's what's called anti-commons problem. When they run into the situation, they don't know if you're infringing a patent or not, and so you better leave your fingers away. And it's actually the worst thing that could happen to a technology. Yeah, democratization of biotech, of course. Hacking is bringing the technology, taking it out of the laboratory, out of industry, bringing it to normal people. And here's an example from the United States. Well, they have a different healthcare system than we have. When it's interesting that in some cases patients, they don't get the medication they need. So there are some people that actually start to make them themselves. So they concoct their own drug. And of course, this is also a problem because maybe they don't make the real thing, make it impure, and it could cause another health risk to them. So here's one situation. Another one is also reflecting the healthcare system in the U.S. It's called MedHack. This took place, I think, in August, just recently. It's a conference where people would invent medical treatments or new ways to help people away from the healthcare industry or healthcare system. So in a way that people would actually take care of their own medical treatment themselves. This is right now, I think, something is quite far away from an Austrian system, for example, or from most of European system, but it might be true in Europe as well in a couple of years. And here's something that's, well, not done for the wetware, it's done for the hardware, the repair manifesto. It's actually, if you have an iPhone or all kinds of new gadgets that you can't repair yourself, if you want to change the battery of your iPod, you probably have to buy a new one. Or if you have a printer that is a couple of years old, they have an inbuilt obsolescence. So after 30,000 pages, they just quit. So it's and you can't repair it, or it's very difficult. And this is a manifesto that wants products to be repairable. First of all, that you actually don't have to buy them, new ones all the time. But also, it would reduce the environmental impact of this all this garbage we're producing. And I've written a little article about that obsolescence and synthetic biology, and having a kind of a written down a nightmare. What would happen if the same obsolescence that we see in iPads and in all kinds of products, if that would happen also in biological systems? So if you buy something and it commits suicide after the guarantee period has expired, it would be kind of an awful situation. Right. So what about rules? What about governance? Who's going to take care that hackers behave or don't do any harm, or not in a bad way? What should we also do? A do-it-yourself governance. This is, by the way, the 10 commandment do-it-yourself kit. So why not go a step further and do some do-it-yourself politics? I mean, there were also some discussions, what kind of rules should biohacker follow? And some people say, well, we should follow the same rules as the scientists and the industry. Others say, no. We are hackers and we make our own rules. So there's also this discussion here, which kind of rules you have to follow. Obviously, there are some rules that everybody has to follow. And then the situation is, who is checking if these rules are really followed? And in another case is that the rules were not written for biohackers. They were written for institutionalized biotechnology. So it's a kind of a different situation. And in a large way, this is not yet defined. Right. So at the end of my talk, I would like to visit some artwork, because some people that are using biotechnology, apart from industry and science, are artists. Okay. So bio art, or art with a biological medium, is one thing. And here I'd like to present two things. The first one is a film festival about biotechnology, about amateur biology. And the second one is an art exhibition we did. Both of them took place last year in Vienna, just right about over the street at the Museum of Natural History. And this is a film festival we had last year with 52 submissions. And I selected two that I think are relevant for this discussion on biohacking. Thank you. kind of a glimpse into the future. Right, the next film is called Grow Your Own. This film actually builds on the idea that people in the future will be able to genetically engineer plants and grow drugs in their own homes. But instead of growing marijuana plants, they actually genetically engineer tomato plants, for example, or all kinds of different harmless plants to produce THC or all kinds of drugs. And how would the police react to that? And this is a film about this.
I'm Mark. I'm a Metropolitan Police Officer with the Genetic Surveillance Unit. I have been for 5 years. I was a regular officer, but I much prefer doing this. My job involves look after the police beehives, the apiaries. We have 43 in all, covering South London and a little bit of Kent. So I go and check on them once a month and collect the pollen which they collect and then take it back for analysis. It's a bit cold for the bees at the moment, so they're all in hibernation, but we still need to keep the hives checked on. Also check that the hives haven't been tampered with in any way. So just checking really that everything's okay, ready for them.
How do you want to collect pollen?
We collect pollen just to analyse it because the bees will pick up the pollen from other plants which are growing in people's gardens or houses. We then analyse that to see if that has been genetically engineered in any way or modified, so we can keep a check on really what people are growing. And these trace elements that the bees bring back help us to do that.
How might it become a police matter if people are growing genetically modified plants?
Yeah, it would become a police matter if they're genetically modifying plants, say, for example, for the infringement of intellectual properties, cultivating illegal substances, where it can be deemed as malicious, and the cross-pollination of these items into foods. So the time that's saved through that and the money was a video camera in each of us, and the cross-pollination of these items into foodstuffs, for example, can cost millions and millions of pounds.
How do you know where pollen has come from?
Well, what happens really is that when the bee has been foraging about and then returns back to the hive, if the bee has been successful in attaining pollen, what will happen is that the bee will do what we call a waggle dance. Now, the hive will pick this up because there's a video camera in each hive. And then what we're able to do is to decode that to tell us where the location of the pollen is. We use bees because they're a natural resource. We don't have the time or money to use human beings. And of course, bees can go anywhere they want. They roam about. So they can go through windows, into gardens, quite freely, houses. And they don't need warrants, whereas we would. And for the time for us to gain a warrant of entry takes a lot of time, a lot of bureaucracy. So the time that's saved through that and the money, we can put police on the streets where they need to be seen. View from up here is absolutely fantastic. It's one of the perks of the job, I like to call it. And the other thing is that the bees don't talk back.
Right, so, I mean, it sounds like genetically modified crops are quite dangerous. Are you against them, or...?
I'm not against genetically modified crops as long as it's used for the greater good. You know, we now have more mouths to feed in the world due to an ever-growing population and anti-aging therapies and climate change. So as long as it's used for the greater good, but not used for a malicious or illicit nature.
Taking a look into a potential future, I'd like to talk about some artwork that really took place and that we had exhibited here in last year in the museum. Here's some impressions from the exhibition itself. We had 10 artists. Most of them were collaborations between artists and scientists. Some of them were art scientists themselves. And here's a little overview about them. Two of them actually on the top left, Art Orienté Objet, the one after our show, they went to win the Golden Nico for hybrid art at Ars Electronica. And this year it was Joe Davis with his bacterial radio that we had exhibited as well. But I would like to talk a little bit more about two objects that might be of interest here. The first one is by Paul Van Oos. He's an US artist and he's working with chill electrophoresis. This is one of the typical analytical tools you find in a biotech laboratory. Normally, you have this, this is a kind of a platform and you put in here genetic probes or genetic samples and then you apply some, they're called restriction enzymes, they're kind of little scissors that will cut up the DNA at specific parts and then you have DNA stretches of different sizes and when you apply voltage or currency then these elements, these DNA pieces, are going to wander out. And the smaller they are, the quicker they are, the farther they can go with the currency. And if they're bigger, they don't go as far. So you get a typical pattern of band, a kind of a pattern of this DNA probe. And this has been termed a genetic fingerprint. So for example, if you, like 10 years ago, if you found some DNA on a crime scene, you would take it, put it into this little well here, apply the restrictions enzymes, and I get a specific pattern. And you can compare that with different suspects and can see which one matches the probe you have found on the crime scene. But he actually criticizes this, the term genetic fingerprint, and invented a method that we could actually take his own DNA and make all kinds of patterns that you couldn't imagine. So in his latest work, he used his own DNA to make the pattern of all the suspects of the O.J. Simpson trial. They had also chill electrophoresis used in this crime scene or crime in this trial and had six or seven different suspects. And he replicated all these different genetic fingerprints of these different people by his own DNA. So he found a way to use always the same DNA but use different restriction enzymes so he could actually paint with this pattern. At the end, this is always an analytical tool in science, but he uses an analytical tool and hacks it in a way and makes something synthetic out about it. He's making pictures like the ID sign, like copyright sign, hand and egg, skulls and bones, infinity and zero and one. He's painting with these objects. This is Tour van Baarn, a Belgium artist, and he worked together with art scientists from Imperial College in London. They were using the biobricks I described at the beginning of my talk and also engineered E. coli. It's also a gut that not just lives in our, a bacterium that doesn't only live in our gut, but also in the gut of pigeons. So the idea was to engineer the bacteria that live in the gut of pigeons, feed them to pigeons so they would live inside the pigeon. And the change that were made to this bacteria were in so far that they would produce a soap-like substance. So instead of defecating and being a nuisance, they were actually shit soap. And so he also built a kind of a pigeonry you can put on your window, on the car, on the windshield, so that the pigeons would land, would actually attract, try to attract the pigeons that would clean your windshield. In a way, he's playing with the stigma of the pigeon that is a flying rat that is dirty, you don't want to have it. But by changing genetically engineering the bacteria, or enhancing, hacking the pigeon bacteria system, you would make something quite adorable that you would don't want to have in your urban system. And yeah, this is my last was my last slide. It gives you an idea about the environmental implications of that, how you could actually change different biological systems, what to think about them, how we could use them. And if you have more questions or anything else you don't want to ask right now, but maybe in a couple of days, feel free to contact me. Thank you.